Hi everybody, I'm Seamus, and with me is Josh.
But I thought the Campster is with you.
And Campster is also with me.
Hello there.
And Rutskarn and Mumbles are not with me. So let's talk about what we're doing this week. Christopher,
it's cool kids party now.
Yeah, this is the uncool kids party. This is the cool kids
Shut
aren't
up.
Here party.
I have to go then. Goodbye.
It's too late. The stench of uncoolness will cling to you.
Damn it, I guess I'll hang out with you lame nerds for a little
Yay!
While.
Actually, I think this will be an interesting experiment because there were 5 people in spoiler warning this week, which involved a lot of crosstalk, and I'm curious to see how the crosstalk differs in a podcast episode with only 3 people. Anyway.
Yeah.
See? Right there. It's crosstalk. Eh? It's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, right? I see. Chris, what are you doing this week? What did you do? Tell us the story.
Oh, God. Most of my week has been spent playing and editing footage from Thief. The original, not the one that is probably out by the time you're reading this. I'm probably suffering through that as you're listening to this right now. So that just be glad you're not me.
I also picked up Thief, so I will be playing it through along with Campster. And we will be discovering its secrets. I can't wait for next week.
I have not decided it's gonna if be I fun. Want to play Thief yet, to buy Thief and play the train wreck.
Everybody knows it's going to be a train wreck, but everybody wants to see it happen. Everybody wants to be there when the wreckage happens.
That is like the thing I'm thinking about. It's like, man, do I really want to actually buy this and kind of tell the developers that your shitty game is worth my money, because it's not really, but at the same time, I really do kind of want to see this train wreck evolve firsthand.
Yeah, you realize we're paying to take part in the conversation about how horrible it is. That's why we're putting up this. It's $44 right now on Steam, and we've paid money so that we can be part of the conversation about how horrible the game is, because we know it's terrible and we know it's not worth $44, and we know in 6 months it'll be $15.
Well, has that ever worked out though? Like me and I steep some like freaking Zelda monster. Me and Seamus are probably both gonna write about it. Josh, I don't think you're gonna write about it, and therefore, has it ever worked out like paying to be a part of a disaster or a train wreck just to be there? Like, I played Duke Nukem. I played Daikatana. These train wrecks are never, like, if you're not actually going to write about them, fun to play through. Like, at all.
I don't know. I was almost in on the SimCity stuff and decided at the very last minute not to buy it. I guess that was a good decision.
God, I was in on that too. Why do I buy all these crappy games?
I was skipping Mass Effect 3 until the ending controversy blew up, and I just had to see it for myself. I wanted to be part of the conversation.
But Mass Effect 3 is kind of a unique snowflake, though, because it...
Yeah, it is.
It was a... I mean, even Mass Effect 3 itself, onto itself, was a fine game until that last end. I mean, yes, I know we've complained about it into the ground, but it was salvageable until that last 2 hours.
I've often said if it didn't have the expectations of the first Mass Effect game hanging off it, I probably never would have looked at it and never would have gotten outraged at it. So it is a different kind of weird case. Where Thief going in, yeah, we're not expecting it to wrap up the previous Thief game. We haven't hung our hopes for the Thief franchise on this game. We know this isn't a successor and we're not looking to continue a story that was begun. So yeah,
I'm really more worried that it's gonna come out, not sell enough, and take like the whole Eidos Montreal studio down with it, like one other certain PC game slash AAA console game that recently had its studio fail because it wasn't that great.
Yeah, do we want to talk about that? I'm gonna confess
Yeah, we're gonna
something
have to.
here. I have not followed that story. I have scrolled past like 50 links regarding that story and have not and the further I got behind, the more reading I needed to do to get caught up. So if you could just introduce it, I literally will be hearing the news as you tell it to me. That is how far behind on the news I am in this case.
Okay. Josh, do you think you're more well read on this, or do you want me to do?
I mean, I haven't read all of this stuff on it, but basically what happened was beginning of last week, I think it was when they announced it. Or was it the week before that?
No, it was last week. Ken Levine made a
Yeah, it
surprise
was.
post out of nowhere on the Irrational website, basically announcing that in very awkward and in what sounds like between the lines, very intentional phrasing, he was winding down Irrational and deciding to refocus his efforts on a small startup at 2K that will focus on narrative-driven games that involve a lot of replayability and focus on the core gamer, but with much smaller budgets. That was really
I actually like the
awkward
sound of
because,
that.
well, it was really
Just
awkward because it was sort of. Go ahead.
no, just aside from the fact that yeah, a bunch of people have just lost their jobs, I'm like, oh wow, replayability, smaller budgets. Sounds like you're gonna be focusing on gameplay. Man, I can't wait to see what happens. But go ahead, say on.
Well, yeah, the way it was phrased was very much like, oh man, isn't it great that Ken Levine is doing a new studio? And he was almost going to just leave 2K, but then 2K convinced him that it would be better to stay at 2K and fire all his old employees except for like 15 other dudes.
Oh. I
And
mean,
that was
and then
like
we.
really weird because it was like, wait a minute, this is something we're supposed to be happy about?
And then Lee Alexander's piece came out, and a lot of what she wrote about
Yeah.
was frankly hearsay, but it was the sort of hearsay where she's a known game journalist, and she was hearing say from people either at or related to people at the studio, where basically, BioShock Infinite sold around 4 million-ish copies at retail, which was, okay numbers, but that's about the same numbers as what BioShock 1 did with a much smaller install base back in 2000 what, 8.
Yeah.
And when you're only doing that many numbers for a game that was in development for 5 years across that big of a team, basically it
It
was sort
supposedly
of.
cost like $200 million, didn't it? So this is like
I
up
mean,
there
there's numbers.
with like, well, supposedly up there with the Old Republic's also supposed budget.
I don't put much stock in that number. Ken Levine has sort of scoffed at it, and it's never been properly
Yeah.
sourced. But it certainly is an incredibly expensive game across 5 years, and needed to do much better. I mean, I hate to harp on it, but it's the only example I have that's concrete and openly admitted. But the whole EA Dead Space 3 needed to sell 5 million copies. This game sold less than what Dead Space 3 did, and Dead Space 3 was a rote sequel done on budget, on time, across 2 years, not a 5 year sprawling mega epic adventure.
And
So,
Square Enix had
yeah.
the same issue with Tomb Raider, and what was the other PC game that they had that
Thief? Ba-dum-psh.
Yeah, that's not gonna go well. Yeah, and all of those games took a lot less time to develop than BioShock Infinite. So in retrospect, looking at this looks much more like 2K is all okay. We recognize that Ken Levine is an asset as a sort of superstar game developer, brand recognition kind of thing, sort of like Sid Meier is. So we want to keep
Yeah.
him around, but they just spent like 6 years in perpetual pre-production on BioShock Infinite before they finally put out a game that, well received, didn't sell any better than the last game they did on a much smaller budget. we're only going to give him a very small amount of money and people in comparison this time. And he can go this wild is... with that and be in pre-production for the next 10 years, and we don't care.
And this is a correction I've been saying should happen. I mean, this is what we've been... I don't want to say, like, I'm the only person that predicted this. Everybody's been predicting this. They're like, we need to... Project $10 because games cost more. We need to raise prices because games cost more. We need to online microtransactions. We need all this DRM because games cost more. And people have been saying for years, why don't you friggin' just spend less? And we're finally, after all this thrashing around, it looks like that's the correction that's happening, is scale the budgets down. I feel bad for all the people that lost their jobs. And it sounds like there's still some weirdness in the story that I'm missing out there. But long term, this is probably a good thing that we're going to see less focus on gigantic spectacle and more focus on gameplay. Since you can't cut gameplay. The gameplay is much cheaper to produce than the spectacle. That's the stuff that makes it expensive, is the full performance capture cutscenes of, you know, Hollywood quality. That stuff's expensive to make, and I've never really appreciated it all that much.
Well, the problem I've always had with that is, like, you don't appreciate it very much, but a lot of people really do like that. So what happens when it just becomes flat out too expensive for anyone to produce that?
What were you going to say, Chris?
Like, I can't...
No, Josh, finish your idea, Josh.
Go.
Well,
yeah,
I can't imagine the super big, like, trade show spectacle, pre-rendered trailer, crazy, awesome button, bro shooter, AAA industry is ever going to really go away. And I'm not really sure what
I'm not suggesting they're gonna.
This is gonna be.
I'm not suggesting they're gonna just go and make Minecraft now, but by looking at, hey, what can we make? Okay, what do we think our games will make? Let's spend that much money. That's going to force you to say, okay, here's what we can do for gameplay. Now what do we have left over for spectacle? Not, okay, well, we're going to spend $200 million on this and just cram as much spectacle in as we can and somehow it'll just make money, which is what they've been doing. And it's insane. They're going to stop chasing the Call of Duties and the modern... I mean, this is me extrapolating. That's what has to happen based on these types of moves, is stop chasing the super blockbuster and just start making games you can afford to make, anticipating what you can expect to make back on them. And that can't help but be a healthy decision.
I mean, most of the weirdness that's left unexplored is basically... A, Ken Levine's phrasing in that email and or the blog post on Irrational's website, and also the debate over what it means to be an auteur in a game that, you know, when you're an auteur that restarted your game like 6 times in the middle of development and then also got almost all the credit for a game that had a team of 200 plus people. But it really does sound like 2K sort of like, I don't want to say coerced, but certainly... there was political balance acting going on in that I'm shutting down Irrational letter, where he was very careful not to say anything bad about 2K or anything that implied that it was 2K's decision, and it sort of feels like they just sort of said, okay, you're going to take the blame for this, you're going to say you're shutting down Irrational, because what would it look like if 2K came out and said, hey, that studio that made one of the most critically acclaimed games last year, yeah, we shut it all down.
Yeah, I guess I understand why gamers get mad. I don't get mad at stuff like that. I don't get mad at them just making wise business decisions.
Yeah.
I get sad.
To an extent, I mean, can you really blame them for doing any of that? Which I guess Seamus says you really can't. I mean, I can't imagine they were at all happy with how much of Bioshock Infinite ended up getting prototyped, polished, like all completed, and then thrown out the window. Like, you remember the E3, like, what was it, 2010, 2011 trailer where they had all the horse scene where Elizabeth struggles to resurrect a horse and Comstock isn't even the bad guy and there's a great big open world Skyhook combat craziness and not everybody is immediately hostile to you and none of that was in the final game.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's weird because it's hard not to see this as a sign of the times, but what it means is really, really kind of nebulous. Like, what does it mean that Bioshock, a franchise that just 5 years ago was an industry darling and was in the line for movie deals, is now, despite being incredibly well-received, unaffordable, unsustainable, despite, you know, strong, glowing 10 out of 10 in IGN reviews, despite, you know,
game
selling
of the
4
year,
million.
Multiple games
exactly.
of the year.
Like, what does
and
it mean that that doesn't survive?
Right. But I guess I'm surprised the game, the system worked as long as it did. Like, when that game came out and I saw it, I was like, I can't believe this got made, and how do they keep having money to keep ramping up these things? So when I hear this, it doesn't shock me. And what does it mean? I don't know either. I mean, it really depends on what, like, Ken Levine and his team decide to do with whatever money. You know, if they're now being given maybe $30 million, well, what are you going to do with $30 million? I would love to know what they're going to do with $30 million. And kind of the change in thinking you need to go through from, okay, we're going to make this giant epic story and here's all our cutscenes and here's the famous people we're going to get to act in it. And then instead having to say, okay, we get $30 million. What kind of game can we make with this? What can we do? And what will be fun? And I love the idea that they're looking for something with replayability. I think that's a very healthy thing. That's something I've really missed in a lot of spectacle shooters is, or just spectacle-based games, is there's not a lot of replayability.
Oh, I'm done. There's the linear path. I've gone through the whole linear path.
Yeah.
And I could go through and maybe have different guns. Yep.
Yeah.
I think before Infinite came out, at some point, Ken Levine was asked about, like, why do you keep making shooters? And basically said, we keep making shooters because we need to appeal to the widest base possible because of the budget. So, I mean, maybe this is good for Ken Levine.
Yeah.
And well, I mean, go and do, like, a Project Eternity sort of thing, or...
That kind of cuts to one of the things I wanted to say, which was that, you know, when we were talking about how budgets kept there's that tendency for basically when game budgets started growing up, every game had to try to become a mega blockbuster or it would die. Like every genre, platformer, shooters, racing games, all of it. And that's, you know, where we are now.
There wasn't really any middle tier.
Right, and I think maybe that's what we're going to see, is the realization that you can't be an arty Bioshock game or take the artiness of Bioshock and then also have it be a dude bro, shoot everybody Call of Duty game. And you're never going to do Call of Duty numbers with a game idea as wild out there and sci-fi-y as Bioshock Infinite. Whatever other failings the game has. So I'd like to think maybe this is sort of a burgeoning realization that not every game can be, let's just dump $80 million in it and hopefully gamers will like it and it will turn into a Call of Duty or Grand Theft Auto 5. I think that the realization is going to have to be not every game can be Call of Duty or Grand Theft Auto 5.
Since I've been screaming that from the rooftop since about 2009, I kind of feel a little validated by that. Of course, this isn't the whole industry isn't turning, but this is the first of a couple studios to kind of go through this kind of thing where we made an incredibly expensive game and it was critically acclaimed and now we're broke. And I think this is this cancer, this terrible decision-making thing that's been eating the industry alive for all this time is finally coming to a head. And people are deciding, okay, we need to change what we're doing.
Well, I mean, it's just
they have hit rock bottom and admitted they've hit rock bottom and they have admitted they have a problem. That's it. They've stood up and said, "Hi, I'm the games industry, and I'm a spendaholic."
See, I think it's the opposite, actually. I think Irrational is just the canary in the coal mine. I think they went down and nobody was expecting it. And I think we're going to see this become a bigger problem as we reach bigger budgets with the next generation of consoles and games like Watch Dogs, which are, the expectation is you will do the Grand Theft Auto 5 numbers, doesn't do Grand Theft Auto 5 numbers, and then suddenly, somebody's holding a $250 million, loss.
Oh,
And I
I agree
think.
totally. I just mean we've had a couple of these happen, and this is the beginning of a process that's going to keep happening until everybody knocks this off.
I think of all the people, like of all the like middle of the road Call of Duty ripoff, like mediocre franchises, of all the ones it could have happened to, I'm really surprised that it happened to the BioShock guys first. That was not something I would have called. I mean, you and I don't really like BioShock, but a lot of people really liked BioShock, and especially BioShock
And it's
Infinite.
different. It's different. It's not a Call of Duty clone. Whatever criticism I might level at it is not trying to be a modern military. It's trying to appeal to that market, but it's not trying to be that game. It's very much its
Fairness,
own thing.
I don't really think it knew what it was trying to do with its game mechanics.
There was a bit of conflict, but the point is, it has its own flavor. It is not, okay, it is not Homefront, which is just the most cynical type of Me Too game
Please don't remind
development.
me that I actually pre-ordered that.
Oh. Actually, I think that's sort of where these sorts of games are going. I think every once in a while you'll have a game that hits on a certain mechanic set and becomes a mega, ultra, huge success. You'll have a Call of Duty, you'll have a Minecraft or something that gets released as a mid-tier, forgettable game, but for some reason, due to either some sort of story construct or gameplay mechanic, becomes incredibly huge. And once it's proven to be able to do Call of Duty, Grand Theft Auto V, crazy numbers, that will sort of become its own genre, and then it will become a mega budget game, if that makes any sense. Like, the mid-tier games may be launch pads for very expensive projects down the road. Well, I mean, like Josh was saying, there's too much money to be made in a mega budget game if you do it right, if you have the audience. Like, you're not going to be able to convince Rockstar right now that dumping $300 million in a game is a bad idea when they're laughing all the way to the bank with Grand Theft Auto V, or even mid-tier games like Red Dead
Sure.
that did okay.
You know what? That makes sense. It's tr spend small, and if you get a jackpot, then spend the big money. Don't spend the big money. Just they've been going to Vegas. Really, everybody's just been spending crazy money, hoping that they will be the next Call of Duty or the next Grand Theft Auto 5. And if they stop doing that and say, "All right, we'll make a $30 million game, and if it's a smash hit, then we'll pour a bunch of money into it." That's a much healthier approach.
Going to Vegas is, by the way, a pretty accurate representation of venture capitalism.
Especially in the games industry.
Oh, yeah.
I would not put money into making a lot of these games. Way too risky.
I mean, you look at it, and at least the film industry kind of has this down pat. Not that I would say that it's great that all our summer blockbusters are basically the same film, but they know how to make money on movies.
Games, they have a lot fewer just terrible bombs that don't make back their money. Even most box office bombs that, don't do well and get panned still manage to make back the money that they put into them. People were really unhappy with, say, Daredevil or Superman or whatever, but I don't think those movies lost money.
You don't even
And
have to
we've got and
qualify
we've
the
got
Superman
situations
movie,
where,
just any of them.
But the point is, a lot of bad Hollywood movies that are terribly reviewed and poorly received still make their money back, where we've got awesome games that are game of the year and lost money. So yeah, the Hollywood is a lot healthier, or just has a lot better handle on how to not lose money. So, that's what happened at Irrational.
Yeah.
And Josh, have you been
before
playing?
Before we switch topics,
oh, yeah, go ahead.
This is something that I never really figured out. Is Ken Levine's new old studio still Irrational? Because some people have been saying they closed Irrational, and other people have been saying they dialed down Irrational, and I can't figure out which one is actually the truth.
From what I understand, what happened was Irrational is not closed yet. They are keeping themselves open to finish up the DLC for Bioshock Infinite, which is not yet out. They are also keeping their doors open in order for employees to sort of build a portfolio, put their things together, find employment elsewhere, that sort of thing. They have not formally shut their doors.
Which is nicer than kicking everyone out one day and going, hey, we're out of money, goodbye.
This sounds like a pretty controlled closure, and not a everybody comes into work on a Monday with a pink slip. I mean, I haven't read the story. I admit I'm totally ignorant except what I've heard on this show, but I'm kind of positive about how well this was handled. You got the game out, you saw how it did, and you didn't immediately fire everybody, and you're making the corrective steps that they've taken sound like sensible ones based on what we've learned. So I have no criticism based on what I've heard.
But from what I understand, at the end of whatever time period they've allotted, the studio will be closed, and Ken Levine will be opening a, quote, new venture, unquote, which means it will be presumably under a different name.
So really, yeah, that's exactly it. It's going to be him and his 15 people that he wanted to keep. And it's not like they're going to like go to all the trouble to move them to a new office. They're going to go to the same dang building in the morning. It'll just be called something else. So Irrational is closing in name. You could just say Irrational is being renamed. Rebranded. So Josh, what have you been doing this week?
I've been reading about the Irrational closure.
Well, let's talk about no.
I've been busy this week. I played a bit of Europa Universalis 4 with Randy, but I've already talked about that on this show.
Yeah.
I guess we could talk about my beef about how, despite being ostensibly historically accurate, the game is incredibly Eurocentric. And not just because it's called Europa Universalis.
I thought it was named after the Jovian moon, Europa.
Yeah, because that was what the moon was called in 1444, was Europa.
Yep. when they knew about it, and they knew all about it.
Good
Go
use
ahead.
Of the Jovian vocab word there, Seamus, by the way. So, Europa Universalis 4, if you've played Crusader Kings 2, it looks on the surface to be quite similar, but there's a lot of mechanics that are completely different. Like, Crusader Kings 2 had a tech system that was basically like, you would slowly tech up over time, and you didn't really have any control over how this happened. It would just kind of happen, and you had some sliders you could mess with. Eventually, they replaced it with...
Before we go into this, I've always, just based on the screenshots, assumed that this was a Civilization-type game. Can you just tell me, like, what genre it is? Like, what is this game?
Okay,
Just for my own curiosity.
I'm not sure you'd call it a 4X game, because there's not a whole lot of, it's a grand strategy as titled by Paradox, and it's a lot like Crusader Kings 2, which I think you've seen me play, so it's very much like you have all of the historical nations that existed at the time, just kind of hanging out and interacting with one another in a very, very complex series of systems. There is a very strong colonization component because it is set at the beginning of and during the Age of Exploration, so you can go to the New World and establish colonies and, you know, slaughter natives with disease and stuff.
Of course, as you do.
All that good stuff, that great legacy of humanitarian efforts that Europe has given
All
the world.
Hail the white people.
Yeah. The biggest difference, I think, between, well, not the biggest, but the perhaps the most significant difference in terms of how it shifts all the mechanics from Crusader Kings 2 is that in Crusader Kings 2, you are playing as a family, a dynasty of people. So you can, you know, start out in Ireland, and by the end of the game, you can be the Holy Roman Emperor or whatever. You're not locked down to a specific place. You're more interested in getting your bloodline claims on various titles and thrones and whatnot, so you can, you know, take over the world by owning a lot of kingdoms and owning a lot of, like, land personally. Europa Universalis 4 and the Europa Universalis games in general, you play as a nation state, which is a little bit weird because the concept of nation states didn't really exist functionally in 1444, which is when the game starts in Europa Universalis 4.
That's a problem with Civilization 2, though, right? And I don't mean Civilization 2, I mean
Civilization
also.
Yeah, very
also.
Much.
Like, all of civilization since the beginning of recorded time, since before agriculture, there were nation states, and it's
yes.
a little absurd.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a brand new, you're just a bunch of you're basically nomads with no city, but you've got a pharaoh, or you've got a George Washington, and he's your president. Yeah, it is kind of funny.
Yeah, it's not as huge a problem here, because this is, like, getting closer to the point where, at least in Europe, nation-states were really becoming a thing. There's still a lot of that feudalism veneer as it moves into the Renaissance. Like, you can end up with nations in a personal union, which is where, like, several kingdoms are ruled by a single monarch, and stuff like that. So there's still that element of, like, well, there's still some feudalism going on here, because you can still have, you know, thrones flipping between. You've got the Habsburgs running around inbreeding everywhere, and they have monarchs on every throne, and so on. But it plays quite a bit more similarly to something like Civilization, whereas in Crusader Kings you have, like, levies. You go to your vassals and you get them to go to their vassals and so on and raise troops, like, you know, get their peasants together and their small retinue of actual, like, paid people to get together and you know, they've got their, like, 100 knights or whatever and a whole bunch of men at arms, which are just basically, like, farmers that have been conscripted or whatnot, and you get up and you get those guys all together and you go to war. Whereas in Europa Universalis, you have standing armies. You always have standing armies. There are no auxiliaries or peasant conscription things. There's just, like, you have this army. It's standing here. You don't dismiss it after the war is over. It's still there. You can reduce its maintenance, but you recruit an army and it stays with you until it gets blown up, until everyone in it dies. So it plays more similarly to, like, a Civ game in that respect, where you are, like, sort of this nebulous, non-impersonal force of, like, you know, your monarch has a name and some stats and a dynasty, but that's it. And it doesn't really matter if the dynasty changes all that much.
I am Josh of +2 to food.
So you're in Europa Universalis 4, you are not playing as, like, as the Habsburgs. You are playing as Austria. And it doesn't matter if the Habsburgs die off. You don't care, you know, as long as you don't end up in a personal union under someone else.
Fair enough.
But getting back to what I was talking about with the Eurocentrism. So Europe is pretty well modeled in this game and does a pretty decent job of, you know, getting up around 1500 or so and starting to colonize the New World and progressing pretty much as Europe would, at least initially. The problem comes in where the technology system in Europa Universalis 4 is basically, you have these three resource pools, these things called monarch points. And that's administrative, diplomatic, and military. And you can spend these on various things like buildings of various types require a small amount of a certain type of monarch point, like say a barracks might cost 10 military points in addition to gold or whatever. And you can spend it to like, oh, I wanna raise war taxes, so I spend some military points while I'm at war to reduce my unit maintenance. I wanna cement my administration over this province I just annexed, so I'm going to do what is called coring it by spending a bunch of administrative points to like make it clearly my province rather than like something I just took from someone. And these are the sort of resources that are used to abstract sort of all the actions and all the diplomatic and administrative stuff that you would probably see happening in the bureaucracy of a nation state. And you get a certain amount of these every month. You get some of them from the stats of your ruler. So like your ruler might have like a 3-2, like a 3 administrative rank, a 2 diplomatic rank, and a 4 military rank. So from your ruler, you'd get 3 administrative points a month, 2 diplomatic points a month, and 4 military points a month, on top of your base monarch points, which is like how much monarch points you generate naturally, which is 3 in each category for European nations, and advisors you can hire that can increase the point gain in any given category by 3 as well. And you use these points. In addition to all the administrative stuff that you can do with them, to research technology. And technology costs a lot of points. So you might spend, 400 points to up your military tech, whereas the equivalent amount of points to like build a building is like 10 military points or something. And the way that this all works out is European nations have a base tech cost of 100%. And the way that nations are balanced, you end up with things where, like in China, they have a base tech cost of 150%. In India, it's 160%. In sub-Saharan Africa, it's 250%. And in like
That's how they, this is how
the
they keep
Americas,
Europe on top,
it's
so that Europe, it
300%. Yeah, this is part of it, okay? And that sounds pretty harsh itself because there's also the lesser European, like the non-European nations also generate fewer monarch points a turn. Like their base natural thing, like Europe is 3, China is 2, the Americas and sub-Saharan Africa is 1 a month. So they also get less of these, and they're split up into various tech groups. So Western tech group is the one, is the Europe one that has the 100% bonus. And Chinese tech group is the one that has 150% tech cost and whatnot. And all of these tech groups also have all of their own military units, at least land military units. And all of the land military units for all the tech groups that are not Western European, even just like Eastern European or Muslim, are really, really shitty compared to the Western units. So you end up with Europe gets tech much more quickly. Europe has much better military units, and Europe generates the points to do all of this much faster. So you get this kind of triple whammy of, wow, it really, really sucks to not play a European nation. Now you can offset this by, if you're another tech group, by doing something called Westernization, a la Peter the Great of Russia, Westernizing Russia. And it takes like some time and gives you a whole bunch of revolt risk to generate the points needed to switch over to Western tech group. But once you do it, then you're basically treated as a Western nation, and everything that Western European nations have is just normal for you as well. But the problem with this is, especially in the earlier part of the game, the idea that Europe, even during the height of the Renaissance, was significantly technologically more advanced than, say, China is pretty shaky. It's not something that I would say is really well supported by the evidence. And moreover, it gets really, really bad in the late game where you get stuff where, you know, in 1650 or so, Spain can send like 20,000 tercios, military formation.
Are those like donuts?
No, they were pike and shot kind of military guys. They can send 20,000 troops all the way over to China and annex the entire country and not run. And despite the fact that China can field like 300,000 people, their units are incredibly shitty and they can't do anything against the superior white people armies. And it gets really ridiculous. And you can colonize Africa, which also was basically impossible in this time period. Like, the primary reason that the New World was so easily conquered and colonized was the fact that the people living on the New World had been separated from the Old World people for, like, 12,000 years and didn't have any kind of resistance to all the diseases that had cropped up in the Middle East and Europe as a result of agriculture and pastoral societies that had a lot of close interaction with animals. So when the Europeans went over there, lots and lots of people got sick and died to the extent that, like, maybe up to 90% of the population of the entire two continents was wiped out within 100 years of the first European contact. That was not the case in Africa because, of course, there had always been a not well-known connection, like not well-explored connection between sub-Saharan Africa and Europe and the Middle East, but there
right,
was
but
still
they were hardened,
one there.
They were hardened against it so that they didn't just drop dead the moment they met a European.
Like, the reason that Europe was able to colonize Africa was because they had machine guns. And that's not even, like, an exaggeration. That was, like, you look at the actual European expansion into Africa, and it didn't really happen until the later half of the 19th century. But you can do it in this game by, like, 1600.
Josh gets mad at video games. Josh, you quit getting mad at video games.
It's just, they put such effort into making it an historically accurate representation of the world from 1444 to 1821, and they completely just screw up the Eurocentrism angle, which is weird because historians for years have been going like, Eurocentrism really needs to stop. This is really not the case. We need to re-examine this and think about this some more because the idea that white men were inherently better is really, like, not borne out in reality at all. So it bugs me. That's
I can see that.
In conclusion, it bugs me.
Fair enough. Okay, speaking of things that bug you, this week I have been playing Assassin's Creed Black Flag.
Oh dear.
Aww.
I don't hate it. You know, it's a hard series to complain about because really the complaints I have are that it didn't turn into what I wanted it. You know, based on where they it's very like Mass Effect. The first game had these interesting ideas that I wanted to explore, and then later games just kind of went the action schlocky, lazy route. And although in the case of Assassin's Creed, I can't impeach it on gameplay terms. I mean, does anybody have complaints about this gameplay? It's pretty polished.
This
it's got
one?
Lots of variety. Yeah, Black Flag.
Plus the ships.
The ships is fun. I mean, this is not a simulation. This is very arcadey, but darn, it's fun. sail the ships around, blow other ships away with your cannons. It's just fiddly enough to feel, to not feel like you're flying a spaceship. You know, it doesn't feel super easy. It's a little fiddly, a little analog. You've got to get the angles right, and you've got to get your ship speed right, so that you can line your cannons up and hit that other ship, and well, they're bouncing up and down on the waves, and you're bouncing up and down, and you've just got to hit them. And while you're doing it, you got to watch out for big waves. You know, you want to go straight up them and down the other side, and not, you know, have it roll over you sideways. So there's a lot of different things to worry about, keep you interested. Ship combat, excellent. Fighting combat is basically what it ever is. It's a lot of counter-punching with your sword. Oh, I just stand here, wait for somebody to try and kill me, and then I counter them to death.
I remembered them changing that up in the later games of the series, where it wasn't so... Like, I remember, of course, the first game was all stand here with, like, 10 guards surrounding me and wait for the first one to twitch and then hit the counter button and kill them.
Yep. Well, this one is even more so because you've got a nice icon. Like, you don't have to watch their movement. You just wait for the red icon, hold down the counter button, and now you have a choice. You can kill them. You can shove them. You can shove them away. But it's like, why would I do any of these things? Why wouldn't I just friggin' kill him?
Now I'm imagining a non-lethal Assassin's Creed playthrough.
Yeah, why would I shove this guy off to the side instead of just shanking him? I don't understand that, but it's an option. You can choose to not kill somebody when you counter them, but whatever. So it's the gameplay they've always had, a little bit more polished, a little bit more variety. What frustrates me about the game, what really bugs me, is what they did with the tone and the lore. You remember the first game, Altair is, he's been training his whole life to be this assassin, and he's a special one, and he's like the best of the best of the best. And everybody's like, oh, Altair, he's arrogant, but we can't fault him because he's so good. And in this
I thought, like, at least in the beginning of Assassin's Creed, it was much more like he thinks he's the best, but he's clearly not, and he keeps fucking up. So, what's-his-face, Duncan from Dragon Age, goes, no, okay, you need to relearn the basics. Give me all your equipment.
Well, no, he says, give me all your equipment, because he's too arrogant, and he killed somebody he should not have killed.
Yeah.
He has terrible judgment, but good technical skills, put it that way. In this game, I'm going to spoil the opening to the game. You are not an assassin. You are literally a pirate. You meet an assassin, kill him, and steal his outfit. Pose as an assassin. Then you, like, get somewhere and they're like, oh, you're an assassin. Well, show us what you can do. And you walk into the little training area where it's got dummies showed it. And you could do the, you know, drop kills, surprise kills, kill somebody out of a pile of hay, and your character basically bullshits his way and guesses how to do all this. It's Ezio even worse. Not only did Ezio became an assassin with almost no training. He became an assassin with 10 minutes of training. This guy became an assassin with no training while somebody was watching him, and he guessed at everything he did. It was just so stupid. Just like, I could not believe how dumb it was.
Even at that, like, Ezio had a bunch of parkour training of sorts by, you know, climbing around Florence in the Renaissance all the time.
Well, this game, you have that as being a sailor. So you're always, you were always crawling up masts and stuff. And so that's like, all right, that's a good enough excuse, you know. Sailors are always climbing up and down to unfurl the sails or tie it up or whatever they do. And, you know, they talk about having fish hooks for toes, that kind of thing. So that wasn't too bad, but the idea that you're this ace assassin instantly knows how to use the wrist blades.
Like, was it very much like, oh, you're the chosen one kind of situation where it's in your blood?
I think that's where it's going. I haven't gotten far enough in the game, and maybe they'll hand wave it later with that. But it just, it didn't, the scene didn't work for me. We've been told that being an assassin is a big deal, and here's this guy that completely bullshits his way into it. And the other thing I'm frustrated with is that the meta story of, like, what you're doing outside is really boring and dumb, and I don't know what they're doing with it. Chris talked about it before.
I can't believe they're still actually doing that.
Yeah, where you are a new hire at a video game company, and I have no idea, like, it doesn't leave you with any questions. It's just like, yeah, this is the new setup. I'm not playing the game going, I need to find out what's going on here. Like, in the first game, you're like, all right, what is it that these crazy people want to find out from Desmond? And in this game, they're just like, yeah, you're just sit in here in the Animus and play. Just sit in here and play the game within a game. And I'm not sure why they... I'm not sure. It's not even clear what you're doing. Are you making a video game? Or are you making a movie? What do they want? And it's not very interesting, and there's no tension in it. There's no threats. There's no conflict. It's just literally like, welcome to the video game studio. Here's your desk. And it just struck me as being very flat and dumb and not... And there's just no payoff to what they've been doing with that meta story. After going to all that trouble to set up this Animus idea, they've never done anything with it except wasted your time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised they're sticking with it after like Assassin's Creed 3 and all the flack it took for how awful the Desmond stuff was.
Well, I mean,
and rather than
they
killed him.
Well, and then they bring him back in this game.
Planning to kill Desmond at the end of Assassin's Creed 3.
I didn't know
it's like that mean-spirited. They don't bring him back from the dead. I mean, they bring him back as like a plot device. Like the whole idea is that
into Desmond and start playing just the Animus segments of the first 4 or 5 games all over again.
No, but the Animus does beg the question of what happens when you start reliving the memories of someone using the Animus. But regardless, basically the idea is that you know, Evil Corp grabbed Desmond's remains and are using Desmond's remains to basically make all the video games they make. And you walk into Satan Corporation and you've got, you know, Bob Evil as your main boss, basically literally telling you what to do, and it's just so transparent about, I don't know, it's terrible. It's so cheesy, but it's so dedicated to the mythos it's set up.
That all of these names are the actual names in the game. Bob Evil and Satan Corp.
It's actually a reference to
Satan
Time Chasers.
Corp
but
blend of a brand of blenders.
I kind of wish that he was played by the guy from Time Chasers, the evil business guy from Time Chasers, because that would be awesome.
It's a shame because they never went... The stuff I loved about the first game was that idea of, like, this Templar versus assassins. And since then, it's become more and more cheap, silly, obviously being made up as you go along, not paying off anything, picking up. But it feels like a comic book, really. Like a comic book that keeps changing hands, so there's never any payoff, because one writer picks up and doesn't know what to do with what the previous guy did, so he just, like, goes, oh, yeah, that character, I don't know what to do with them, so I'll kill him off. And then, oh, here's an interesting idea I'll bring up, and I don't like this setup, so I'll just change it. And instead of forming arcs, it's just this meandering, plotless, boring thing that doesn't deliver on any of the themes they've been talking about.
It's like if Lost or the X-Files was additionally very boring.
Yes. But it's hard to get mad at the game because really it never... I'm mad at it for not paying off on ideas that it introduced in the first game, and now we're at the fourth game. It's pretty obvious it was never... I mean, after the whole thing with Ezio, it's obvious they were never going to be the game I wanted to be. So can I still continue to be mad at it for continuing to not magically transform into what I wanted? It's like, I just wish.
You know what is a great metaphor for the Assassin's Creed franchise? It'd be like like the f take the first two-thirds of the Matrix, and so you're learning about what the truth is and what's going on, and we don't really know, there's this virtual reality, what's going on, and then like the last third of the Matrix, take that, cut it away, and replace it with the gif of the guy, the aliens guy, just doing aliens, and that is Assassin's Creed.
Yes. What is this mystery? It's aliens. Well, what is this technology? It's aliens. Yeah. And it's just this lazy thing that's posted or that's just slapped onto everything. In the new game, they're like, your character is bullshitting his way into this cult. I like the idea that he becomes a Templar. He's just like, oh, I'm joining up, and they're like, welcome to the Templars. So you join the Templars, and this character has no idea what's going on. But then they start talking about precursors and magical technologies, and your character isn't even like, huh, this is really something.
Man, he's my like, wacky coworker is just so crazy.
He's just like, okay, whatever. Of course, I'm only like somewhere in the second or third act. I'm not that far into the game, so maybe we get a payoff, and I'm not actually that invested. It's just I wish this had been done differently.
But it's still the best pirate game since Sid Meier's Pirates.
I can get behind that idea. I can get behind that. I like the piratey stuff in this game. It's all interesting.
Like, that's is it best... much more like pirate-style open world than it is like Assassin's Creed 1 and 2 and so on, where it was like, okay, you're in this city for this mission, and you're going to hang around for a while, and then you'll go on to the next part in our linear story.
Josh, it's a weird mix of both. Like, it's open world in the sense that once you pass about the two-hour mark, once you've got your boat, you are pretty much free to go anywhere that is open to you, but places still only...
That's
they do that
I'm
thing where
now.
This memory is offline. You cannot do that. Until, you can't come to this city yet because you don't have the memory for it. But once you get the memory, like... It's like playing Assassin's Creed to open up areas, and then as areas open up, they're just there forever, and you can play the game like a Sid Meier's piracy game. But if you ever get stuck and you're like, I want a new city, play more of the main quest, it'll open up a new city, and then, hey, you get new cities to keep playing your pirates game in. So it sort of like splits the difference.
Once and you instead have it, of you like, Ezio can, yeah, wait. You remember Ezio could upgrade all the buildings he owned around town. In this game, you can upgrade your ship. And that's what you're doing, upgrading your pirate ship. I do think it's funny that after all these games, they finally hit on this magical formula of pirates. Like, they're going to want to stick with this. People love this pirate theme so much. What are they going to do next game? I wonder if they're going to want to do another Ezio, or they're going to string this guy along for titles. Because if you jump... Yeah, because if you jump forward again, it's like, where are we going to go next? Industrial Revolution? Well, I mean, you know, Wild West? Actually, that would be kind of cool. But, you know, you'd be giving up this pirate ship that everybody loves.
So that was the thing that really bugged me the most about the franchise. It was so great, like, the first two games were like, yeah, crusades in Syria and the Levant,
yeah,
and the Holy Land. And then the next game was like, yeah, Renaissance Italy. And then the next game was, yeah, Renaissance Italy. And then the next
and
game
the next
was...
One.
Late Renaissance, like early Renaissance, Constantinople, Istanbul. Okay. and they just kept going with like, oh, we're doing, and then the next game after that was like, oh, American Revolution. Okay. I guess.
I'm the rare defender of Assassin's Creed 3.
I wish it had been the French Revolution instead, just because everybody had been like asking for the French Revolution. B, it's a French studio. C, it's like less well known in the Americas because our own revolution was happening. Well, in the United States anyway, the American Revolution was happening like shortly before that, and we don't like to think about what was happening during the rest of the world when we're talking about, oh yeah, American patriotism.
Yeah, I would have loved the French Revolution. I would also have loved for them to move the show a little further east, maybe show up in China or Japan or something like that. But we never went. Or India would have
Man,
been good.
Romance of the
We
Three
got lots of
Kingdoms,
cool stuff.
China.
Oh, it'd be so great. But instead, it's like, yeah, American Revolution.
Hang
I'm
out
like,
with
eh.
Jingye Liang and make crossbows that can shoot lots. That'd be great.
Oh. That would have been great. And I would have liked to have a female protagonist. And I know there was the one on the Vita or wherever, but that doesn't count.
It did get
It
re-released on
got
the
ported.
PC. It's on
Did
sale
it?
right now, although it won't be when you guys
Hmm.
hear this. It's
Liberation, and it's got the French
Yeah,
Creole lady,
it's
and
15 bucks right now.
it's the only character that, from what I understand, is not related to Desmond, so it's got that going for her too.
Ho ho. Well, what's the meta game in that one like?
I can't remember. It's a prequel to the game you're playing now, Seamus, because this is the first one where Estabergo or whatever is making the video game, where it's got that meta narrative. Because Assassin's Creed 3 was not supposed to be a game that Estabergo or Estabergo, whatever made. I really don't care enough about the
Abstergo.
franchise to remember. I don't
Abstergo.
care to
Yeah.
know the name of the
I
company.
prefer Estabarabago. We'll call it that from now on.
I like it. I like that. I feel that that should be canon.
But I mean, that's why pictures of her are up everywhere in their offices, Seamus, is that was the supposed to be in the canon. The game they Liberation was the game they made right before they made Black Flag, even though Black Flag is the game you're playing, and it kind of doesn't make
Kind of
sense.
confusing, yeah. What the hell?
Wait, so you're saying that Liberation was set right before Black Flag in terms of
No,
like
no, no.
chronology of
In Black
It's
Flag, you
literally.
see in yeah, in Black Flag,
Oh.
they show you posters and they're like, "Hey, have you played our game
Oh,
Liberation?" And you're
so
like,
in the in-game, in the in-universe video game company that your character is a part of, Liberation is the video game that they made, is what you're saying.
Yes.
This is a
And
really
in
fucking
Liberation.
stupid, weird canon that's going on here.
And in Liberation, since it came out shortly after Assassin's Creed 3, they didn't know what to do with the main story, so they also had it be about the video, like the meta narrative is also the video game guy doing research on the lady that you play in Assassin's Creed Liberation. So it's like that game is about making the game that you're playing, and then this game is about, and Black Flag is about making Black Flag, but also referencing the fact that Liberation did get made. Are you confused? Because I'm confused.
Huh. That's weird.
I
It's
mean,
just weird.
like it's bizarre that for something that everyone hates a lot, they put so much goddamn thought into it.
Yeah. Yes. It's like watching a riff tracks of Mystery Science Theater the movie.
Oh God, it is.
Yeah, okay. I think I want to wrap things up now. But I want to remind everybody that diecast@seamusyoung.com. I actually want us to do more questions. We haven't done a lot of questions on this show, and that's entirely my fault. And
Okay,
I've
sure,
kind
I'll
of
let
been.
you take the blame. I'm
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I
not
had them sent to
responsible at
you.
all.
I had them sent to you, and I really should have been filtering them myself. And I never leave room for them at the end of the show. And I actually want to do more questions. And I kind of want to use it if our Skyrim spoiler warning show gets slow. And we're like, holy cow, we're hiking across this wasteland with nothing to do and nothing to talk about. Let's do reader questions. So we might use it to that.
That would
So.
never happen, Seamus.
Yeah, especially not in Skyrim. So, if you send a question in, it might show up on this show, it might show up on Spoiler Warning, you never know. Ask a question, see what happens, keep it short. Okay? Say goodbye, guys.
Goodbye, guys.